This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
If the Mexican government elected a communist, if Mexican people elected a communist government, they hijacked the government. And they said, okay, we're reclaiming Texas. And then sent missiles onto San Antonio and Houston. How long would it take for Mexico to be flat?
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. doubles down on Zionist rhetoric justifying Israel's massacre of Palestinians while using anti-Mexican tropes that sound a lot like Trump's.
You have the largest exportation of weapons to the Israeli government coming from here, and we're calling for an end here at the source of it all.
On December 28th, police arrested 14 activists for blocking traffic into Travis Air Force Base in Fairfield, California, to protest the shipment of weapons to Israel.
This has long been the plan, and finally we're at a point where Gaza's being made deliberately uninhabitable, that many other nations may be bribed or strong-armed to take these people.
Even before October 7, the majority of Israeli Jewish citizens favored the relocation of Palestinians from Gaza. Is Israel trying to bribe foreign governments into taking them?
All this talk that he has attributed himself to be a guy that has no connections with the so-called political caste is a complete lie.
Argentina's new president, Javier Milei, represents the rise of fascism in that country. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. continues to ramp up his hardline propaganda supporting the Israeli state's genocide against the Palestinian people. In December 2023, well into Israel's indiscriminate massacres in Gaza, RFK Jr.'s rhetoric took a particularly vicious turn when he used anti-Mexican tropes to justify the massacre of Palestinians. Pacifica's Polina Vasiliev and Freddy Libertad provide analysis.
If I had to give this a title, I might call it Bobby Kennedy Jr. doubles down on Zionist rhetoric justifying Israel's massacre of Palestinians while using anti-Mexican tropes that sound a lot like Trump. Part of the reason I think why it's important that we listen to what Bobby Kennedy is saying on Palestine, which is really despicable, is because his opinions on other topics are often quite good, right? And I think this is what has attracted a lot of people to him and to his candidacy.
Yeah, so much so that Bobby is actually steadily up in the polls in popularity.
Absolutely.
Like you were saying. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think a lot of that is because he, if you listen to enough of him, and I don't really recommend this because his stance on Palestine is just inexcusable and reprehensible and really exposes him for being what I would consider a liar and a fraud. And I'll just say that out loud because I think that's the truth. But the thing is that he has talked about, criticized BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, these entities that control a lot of the wealth of the United States and of the world, right? He's taken a stand on Big Pharma and how they get a pass in terms of doing whatever they want. He was critical of the vaccine mandates, and I think he earned a lot of respect from people. And a lot of people on the left, certainly a lot of liberals who are not the left, but liberals as well as, you know, some people on the left or a lot of people on the left, did not have a good critique of what was happening to the working class during the COVID crisis in terms of the lockdowns, in terms of people losing their jobs, losing their businesses, and getting coerced into taking an experimental medical intervention that I believe people when they say that they've experienced some harm from that. You know, not everybody, but certainly some people have. He's also has like a track record on the environment. He's also, as part of his critique during COVID, would raise the issue of surveillance and the consolidation of corporate media and censorship. So there's like a lot of things there that he sounds really good on. And so, again, I think that the point here is that he's betraying the virtue of truth. He talks a lot about truth. Again, if you do, you know, I've listened to a lot of his talks, a lot of his interviews going back for a couple of years now. And truth is one of his big themes. And he has exposed himself for really being a liar and someone who's enabling genocide on the Palestinian people. This clip that we're going to listen to first, there's a lot packed in there. He's justifying a genocide, but he's doing that while he's using anti-Mexican tropes. So racism against the Palestinians, and then he's using anti-Mexican tropes in his example on why it's okay to, you know, how the Israelis are dealing with Gaza. And yeah, so, I mean, let's just play it and then let's unpack it.
So this is Bobby Kennedy Jr. speaking on December 6th.
But, you know, Hamas has to take the full blame for what happened in Israel. Hamas has been, you know, the Israelis have treated Hamas and Gaza in a way no other nation in the world would treat an enemy that declared war on them 16 years ago and has dropped 30,000 missiles on Israel. How did Israel, what did Israel do instead of going into Gaza, which every other country could have done, just flattened it? If the Mexican government elected a communist, if Mexican people elected a communist government, they hijacked the government and they said, okay, we're reclaiming Texas, and then sent missiles onto San Antonio and Houston, how long would it take for Mexico to be flat? Not long. We would go, and then what if they sent 3,000 terrorists to slit people's throat, you know, burn babies, rape women and all that? We would go in there.
So that's Bobby Kennedy Jr. speaking to, I think it's Valuetainment.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The host is a fellow named Patrick Bet David. I'm not sure how he pronounces his name. And he's at least a conservative, if not a right winger or some sort of kind of right leaning libertarian. And so this audience that Bobby is playing to, and he plays to audiences, and he might tone down his rhetoric depending on who he's talking to, or he might change it up a little bit. But I think this audience is probably open to anti-Mexican tropes the way a Trump audience would be. You know, Trump would talk about, you know, they don't send their good people, you know, they send rapists and whatever, drug traffickers. And so I think Bobby knows better, and I think he knows what he's doing by using this trope of sort of the dangerous, murderous Mexican. He doesn't use the example of Canada, for example. Mm. What if Canada decided that they were going to bomb the U.S. or something? I don't know. It's just a very strange example that he chooses. And he works into anti-communism because part of his example is that, and this is a theme in his discourse in general, he's very U.S. exceptionalist, the great U.S. pageant of democracy and freedom. And the flip side of that is always the anti-communism. So he works that in, that the people of Mexico, and it's funny because he says they elect a communist government, but then somehow the government is hijacked, even though they voted for it. But again, that's classic U.S. exceptionalism, imperialism. So it doesn't really matter if the people vote in a government that's a left-wing government, it's somehow illegitimate, okay? And then this government bombs Texas, right? And then he adds lies, you know, the lies that we've been hearing for the last several weeks now about burnt babies, rapes, and slitting throats, right? So again, I think it's really inflammatory to use that kind of imagery of Mexican people doing this sort of thing to good American people, right? And it's just like how the Palestinians have been dehumanized, that they're just savages. He's using this trope here. I mean, I'm not sure what your opinion is on this, but I just found it like, I was kind of shocked, actually, even knowing what his position is on the Palestinians and how he doesn't think much of them as a people, that he actually dug himself into a deeper cesspool.
He most certainly did. Yeah, with this one. And besides that, he also says that the U.S. would have flattened Mexico had Mexico elected a communist government that attacked the U.S. To reclaim Texas. He's talking on December 6th. This is after Israel has already carried out a vicious bombing campaign and had already flattened, I believe, a good percentage of the civilian infrastructure of northern Gaza, you know, and already was going into southern Gaza, etc.
Yeah, you know, we started out with some of the more inflammatory comments about Mexicans, basically. That's the way I see it. But, you know, of course, he began by saying that Hamas has been making war on Israel for whatever, a decade and a half, that they've been shooting, I think he says, 30,000 missiles. And my question is, how many people did those 30,000 missiles kill? Those 30,000 missiles, a lot of military experts consider those ineffective, inaccurate, and they'll use words like firecrackers. It's not like what Israel did to Hamas in the last couple of months, or shouldn't even say Hamas. It's not about Hamas to the Palestinian people. It's just odd that when he's doing this interview, as you said, Israel basically already flattened. They did what he's saying that they don't do. They did it. And it's just odd that there's like a cognitive dissonance there that he doesn't quite get, that it sort of already happened and it's happening as he speaks, that they are flattening it. And of course, it's okay with him that the Palestinian people are paying this price, even if supposedly Hamas was responsible.
I completely agree with you. Now, you also flagged for us another video in which Bobby brings up the same argument, but at this time he's speaking to a liberal audience. I think I'm talking about Breaking Points.
Right. Let's listen to the second clip because, yeah, he plays it a little bit differently. He uses the same example, but it's a little bit different, and we could unpack that as well.
Here's Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speaking on Breaking Points with Crystal Ball and Sagar and Jetty.
So Israel, instead of going in and attacking, you know, if Mexico elected a communist government and the communist government began sending shells onto civilian populations in San Antonio and Houston and say, we're going to retake Texas, which they have a legitimate claim to, we're going to retake it. How long would it take us to go in there? It wouldn't take us very long. We would go in and we would do whatever it took to take out the people who are sending this.
I think what stands out here for me is that he doesn't talk about flattening Mexico in this clip with this audience. This audience likely has a considerable amount of people who would consider themselves liberals, maybe even progressive or left. And so he brings up the Mexico example, but it's not as vicious as he does with the other show, right? He doesn't talk about flattening it. He doesn't go on and talk about 3,000 Mexicans coming over and slitting people's throats and burning babies and raping women. So he actually tones it down. And I think that's what's most interesting is that he's a typical politician. People want to think of him, those who are supporting him, as being somehow different. When in fact he is playing to audiences and is tailoring his rhetoric to the audience. Here, if you notice, he says when he talks about Mexico wanting to, in his theoretical example, wanting to retake Texas, he actually says which they would have like a legitimate, I don't know what his exact words
claim, are. Right.
Yeah, right. And so he doesn't say that on the other one. And it's very interesting that he doesn't. And it's important because this audience just might know something about the history of Texas, which is that Anglo-Texans came in when it was still a part of Mexico. Mexico had outlawed slavery, and these so-called founders of Texas, of the Texas that eventually became part of the U.S., they kept their slaves, right? So there's just a lot of history there in terms of just the example of Mexico itself. You know, using an anti-Mexican trope, because there's just been so much racism against Mexican people here in the United States, going back to the mid-1800s up to the present. And he should know that, and he should not be using these kind of examples. It wouldn't change the fact that his position on the Palestinian people is despicable. But what it does is it reveals that he can use this sort of dehumanizing language not just about the Palestinians, but apparently about Mexicans as well. And I think this is something that really people should take a look at if they really think that this guy's progressive. He likes to talk about how his family, they supported civil rights, they support Latinos, they support the Black community. And I just think that he's being very vicious with his language, and that language is translating into an actual genocide in Gaza.
That was Pacifica's Polina Vasiliev and Freddy Libertad. Their entire discussion can be found on YouTube at Against the Narrative. Nigeria, Bolivia, Chile, Angola, Puerto Rico y Tunisia. Argelia, Venezuela, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Mozambique, Costa Rica, Camerún, Congo, Cuba, Somalia, México, República Dominica, Tanzania, fuera Yankee de América Latina, franceses, ingleses y holandeses, yo te quiero libre. الوضع بدو الرضع صار الوضع بدو الردع لكل السيد تحرر مستوطن يقتل مدلك المصاب حكيت ألف كان ألف راق بالهدار الإعلام سلاح مطيب فبركوت أما لما ألمي يدي نرجع الواقع كما That was Ana Tijoux, Somos Sur, featuring Shadia Mansour. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm In Garrison. Travis Air Force Base in Fairfield, California, near Sacramento, is the largest U.S. base for the shipment of military equipment and weapons to U.S. bases and allies, including Israel. On December 28, hundreds of opponents of the U.S.-Israeli war on Gaza rallied at the base. They blocked the main entrance for 3 hours, and 14 were arrested. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke to protesters at the rally.
Newsom, Newsom, you can't hide.
Newsom, Newsom, you can't hide.
Newsom, Newsom, you can't hide.
We charge you with genocide.
We charge you with genocide.
My name is Tarek, and we're here protesting the transfer of weapons to Israel because these weapons are mainly used to bomb civilians. And so far, most of those civilians being women and children. And it's creating a genocide in Palestine. It's not helping the situation. And the tax monies of the U.S. people is culprit in this. This is happening from a U.S. military base. The U.S. is the major weapons supplier to Israel. And most of this support is going without any check, without conditions, without much scrutiny into how it is being used. And it's been that we are not learning from the lessons from Vietnam through Afghanistan to Iraq to Yemen. It's been happening over and over and over, and it seems like the weapon industry is controlling us. And our memory is so short. We went into a mirage. We went into nothing in Iraq, in Afghanistan. We spent 20 years destroying Afghanistan, and then we left. And it seems that we are just creating another catastrophe using our weapons. It's a U.S. law that weapons, U.S. weapons, should not be used to kill civilians and to bomb civilians. And this, Israel has like a special treatment when it comes to this. And nothing is scrutinized. There is tons of evidence. There is tons of evidence. And even the president himself, even Biden himself, spoke to this. And he said that they should do that. But despite all this, despite admitting that civilians being killed, they did not stop the shipment of weapons to Israel. All the world is talking about it. France is talking about it. All the traditional allies of Israel is talking about it. yet they are doing nothing about the shipment of weapons. And this is actually what decides the trajectory of the war. This is actually what decides when the war is going to stop. If you continue to ship weapons to Israel, this is going to continue. The only way to stop this is to stop shipment of weapons to Israel. They bombed hospitals, they bombed mosques, they bombed churches, they bombed UN bases, they bombed schools, they bombed nurseries, they bombed bakeries, they even bombed the wheat, the only wheat mill, you know, in Gaza. You know, imagine, like, what's in the wheat mill? They bombed the wheat mill that produces a flour for people to make a bread. They even bombed that. They killed more than 100 journalists so far, more than 120 doctors. They arrested doctors. Everything you can imagine or labeled as war crime being done in Gaza. I can't think of anything they left. They've done every war crime you can think of.
My name is Angela Marino. Right now, people have seen what the state is capable of doing. And mothers, family members, people who care, who have an ounce of humanity in the face of it, have decided to come out from 4:30 this morning and stand here to block the entrances to this base where they're producing exactly the arms that are dropping on human beings who are our family members, who are our loved ones. And so we are here to say no. We will not let this happen on our dime. We're not going to continue to let this kind of slaughter exist. And we're going to fight like hell to the end to make sure that this doesn't happen.
Omar Al-Tamimi, Youth for Palestine, you have the largest exportation of weapons to the Israeli government coming from here. And we've seen what that's done in the past 2 months. We see the decimation of lives. We see the what's being called an ongoing genocide by genocide experts. And we're calling for an end here at the source of it all.
Germans were bad and us Jews were good. Hebrew school dad said, you've been slacking. Just don't grow up and drive a Volkswagen after 2,000 years. Of subjugation, State of Israel's the symbol of our liberation. Lie, lie, lie. Why 10,000 Gazan children had to die? Lie, lie, lie. Why 10,000 Gazan children had to die? Generations of occupation, illegal settlements, walls, and humiliation, censured by 95% of the United Nations. AIPAC owns the president and congressional delegation. Ask Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney about how AIPAC punishes those who speak out. Lie, lie, lie. Why 5,000 children had to die? Lie, lie, lie. Why 10,000 Gazan children had to die? Well, I heard your story about the Arabs' intent. Camel's nose today, tomorrow we're paying rent. Just the West Bank is fine with me, but tomorrow Palestine from the river to the sea.
All right.
Those were the voices of activists at Travis Air Force Base in Fairfield, California, where they were protesting the shipment of U.S. weapons to Israel. 14 people were arrested and charged with failure to disperse during a quote-unquote riot. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke to some of them after they were released from the Solano County Detention Facility. Charges against the Travis 14 remain, and they go back to Solano County Court on February 23, 2024.
Basically, we blocked, it seems like there was four gates that were blocked. We were in the north side, and some of us got arrested because we blocked the entrance during the time of the rush hour when there was a lot of cars trying to get in and out, and we blocked them. We stated why we're here, and we told them that it was because we're trying to stop genocide, basically. And against the Travis Air Force Base, the use of the Travis Air Force Base to send bombs that kill the children in Gaza, that kill people in Gaza, and that we also stated that the general here should be aware that they could be charged with the commission of a war crime because of the fact of what they're doing, you know? So all of us, we're here, we're committed to trying to stop genocide.
Imani Haldin-Harto. It was my first time, so nothing that bad. We were in like the back part of the paddy wagon, so there were six of us back there. And then they left us there for a whole, like, I would guess like an hour, just like sitting on our hands, so that was not very cool. But one of us really had to go to the bathroom and they let her out, so it was pretty humane. And then when I first got arrested, I was not manhandled at all. They moved me from car to car, but it was always very gentle and yeah, it was not a bad experience. It was stressful. They took my blood pressure and they were like, "Do you have high blood pressure?" And I was like, "No, I'm just really stressed out." But yeah, I'm happy to finally be doing something.
Why did you do this?
I guess I wouldn't have wanted to sleep with myself if I didn't. It's just, I think part of living in a democracy is that we have all these rights and privileges, and if we don't exercise them, then we're complicit. So. That's why.
It has to stop.
Yes, it has to stop, exactly.
Refusing to leave the scene of a riot. Yeah. So, obviously, there was zero riot. So, as the video footage shows, makes abundantly clear. They read multiple warnings, which is standard, including this is unlawful assembly, failure to disperse can result in bodily harm, you know, and arrest, etc. And then we held it for about an hour at the North Gate, and it was very effective. There was cars just backed up, and some of the cars were supportive. And then there was this rather insane right-wing neighbor who had private property right next to the base who came out waving the American flag and was calling us terrorists and supporters of terrorists. Yeah. But we didn't engage with him, you know. But when we were arrested, he kept giving the police all the thumbs up. And
free, free Palestine, free Palestine, free Palestine. Free Palestine, free.
That was Ska P, Intifada. Even before October 7, the majority of Israeli Jewish citizens favored the relocation of Palestinians from Gaza. That's according to Anthony Lowenstein, an Australian-German freelance investigative journalist and author. He says that bribing other countries to take in Palestinians is a decades-old Israeli policy. He spoke to Al Jazeera.
Israeli politicians and pundits have been discussing moving Palestinians in Gaza to other countries, including regions like South America and the African continent. Knesset member and former UN ambassador Danny Dannon said Israel had received inquiries from countries willing to take in refugees from the Gaza Strip. In an interview on the Israeli radio station Kan Bet, Dannon said he's been in contact with a number of countries in the past on this issue, such as South American countries and African ones. He added that some of them asked for payment in return and other forms of contributions. This is not new. There's quite a history of Israeli politicians discussing projects of massive transfers of Palestinians. According to the Jerusalem Post, Israel secretly encouraged or planned to encourage the emigration of 60,000 Palestinians to Latin America. That was back in 1969. Declassified documents of an Israeli meeting held 51 years ago revealed plans of a massive transfer of Palestinians to Paraguay as part of an agreement between the two countries. The plans included Israeli funding for flights transferring Palestinians who agreed to leave Gaza, a $100 grant for each of them, and $33 per person to the Paraguayan government. And since 2014, Israeli experts and politicians have discussed at length plans to relocate Gazans to the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. Well, Anthony Lowenstein is an independent journalist and author of The Palestine Laboratory. So let's start, first of all, with the latest comments. How seriously should we take comments from people like Danny Dannon about transferring Gazans outside of their native Gaza?
Well, very seriously, as you said, Sammy, in your introduction. The fact is that there's been Israeli plans to remove huge amounts of Palestinians pretty much from the beginning. People know a lot about 1948, the Nakba in 1967. There's actually been huge amounts of other examples. And in some ways, what Israel has, inverted commas, is a problem, that they have too many Palestinians in their view. And over the decades, there's been huge amounts of plans to remove anybody who's either not Jewish or, for example, black Africans, and we can talk about that later. But ultimately, Israel takes this very seriously. And in fact, just the last few days, the Israeli foreign minister came out on Israeli television and essentially said to countries, email me, call me, literally, and we're willing to discuss ways for you to take huge amounts of Palestinians. So this is a serious issue that the world should take very serious notice of.
What kind of dehumanization does that create when you talk about people, not just any people, people in their native land, as some kind of, I don't know, merch on eBay that you can just email if you want me to ship them off to you?
You know, one of the most underreported issues of what's happening in Israel-Palestine, both since October 7, but certainly before, is actually that Israeli society, Jewish society, has been radicalized. And what I mean by that is that public opinion polls long before October 7 and certainly since have shown actually the majority of Israeli Jews support the removal of Palestinians from Gaza. Now, this was happening before October 7, and in fact, there was a poll just this week that found that around 70 to 80% of Israeli Jews support the idea of finding somewhere else for Palestinians who are native, as you say, to Gaza, to be removed. Now, Israel claims this is somehow voluntary, which is nonsense. I mean, Gaza is being made uninhabitable deliberately, and therefore there are many other countries that potentially are being forced or strong-armed or offered other deals, such as weapons, as I document in my book, to take Palestinians. And the question is, which countries will actually take those people, if any?
Anthony, this is not theory, is it? Take us through the history of plans being discussed and reports that they were to some degree actually implemented to transfer Palestinians to Latin America.
Look, as soon as you touched on this in your beginning, as soon as the 1967 war happened, there was a convening of the Israeli cabinet, and there was a serious discussion at the highest levels to find ways to remove what they regarded as excess Arabs that would dilute, in their view, the Jewish population. As you said, Paraguay was examined, and Paraguay, to be clear, at the time was a dictatorship, which after World War II had taken in some Nazi war criminals, including Joseph Mengele, who was the notorious angel of death doctor at Auschwitz. This was no impediment to Israel potentially working with them. That plan didn't really happen, and only a handful of Palestinians actually left. And over the decades since then, there's been a number of other attempts to take in or force or convince other nations that were seen as pro-Israel, Brazil amongst others. It's never really worked, is the long and the short of it. That A, virtually no Palestinians have wanted to leave, and virtually no other nations have been able to be bribed enough. But the plans have always been there, and that's been accelerated since October 7.
And there is something of a history of transferring people to Africa, right, from Israel. Talk us through that and the statements that have been reported in the media, quoting Israeli officials, referring to African migrants, asylum seekers, as a threat to Israel's Jewish character or as a cancer.
In the last 20 years or so, there was a lot of African migrants who came to Israel, tens of thousands, in fact, because they were fleeing persecution and war in their continent. And this was never particularly popular within Israel because they were not Jewish, of course, and they were seen as infiltrators. As you said, some politicians called them cancers. There were huge amounts of protests around Tel Aviv and elsewhere against these Africans. I did a lot of reporting about this over the years, actually, including I was based in South Sudan in 2015. And bizarrely enough, Israel in the last decade was bribing and promoting the concept to Rwanda and Uganda, giving them money, giving them weapons to take huge amounts of Africans. Africans are then dumped from Israel in those countries and then left to fend for themselves. Many ended up in South Sudan, where I met some of them in the capital, Juba. And these people are destitute. They have nowhere to go. They're legitimate refugees. And this, I think, fits into a long pattern where these people, of course, are not Palestinian, but they're not Jewish. This is the key point, that it was seen to dilute the so-called Jewish character of the country. And this was led by Netanyahu, amongst others. And to the point now where over the last decade or so, barely any Africans have been granted refugee status in Israel. And there are some still there, but very, very few. Israel has essentially fortified and ghettoized itself, where it's virtually impossible for Africans fleeing dictatorships in their own continent to come to Israel. So this has a long history, including a recent one, where Rwanda and Uganda, who are now quite close allies of Israel, are essentially bribed and given weapons to take in so-called unwanted people from Israel.
Anthony, briefly, what has that got to do? Take us through the history of what the transfer of people has got to do with the arms trade.
Look, the arms trade has been central to Israel's existence from the beginning. I document this in the book a lot. And this accelerated after 1967. The short answer is that virtually the vast majority of countries on the planet, dictatorships and democracies, have wanted various forms of Israeli weapons or surveillance equipment or repressive tech in the modern era. And this has played in very clearly to nations right now as we speak that I'm sure are interested in potentially taking some kinds of numbers of Palestinians from Gaza. Now, we don't know exactly which nations are being talked to. I could only presume it's going to be Israeli-friendly countries in Africa, potentially the new leader in Argentina, who's madly pro-Israel, a far-right fundamentalist dictator who's just taken over there. And it's pretty clear that nations like that will want money, but also weapons, because Israel's key export asset for years is exporting the weapons of dictatorship and occupation from Palestine to those nations. So the occupation, therefore, is exported. It's a key part of Israel's raison d'etre, and that's going to continue, I suspect, in years to come. So this serious threat, it's a serious threat that Israel is looking for nations. Now, they won't take 2.3 million Palestinians, but they might take 100,000, 10,000 here, 10,000 there. And that's not just the Sinai, which obviously is Israel's great dream, to the point, finally, Netanyahu just this week spoke to a Likud meeting in Israel where he said openly, it's not a secret, our plan is to expel Palestinians. This is the plan. And yet so far, there's been no serious response from the US or any country. This has long been the plan. And finally, we're at a point where Gaza is being made deliberately uninhabitable, that many other nations may be bribed or strong-armed to take these people.
Anthony, you mentioned the statement by Netanyahu, and it's not just politicians. Let's take a look at this opinion piece in the Jerusalem Post, where it explores why moving to the Sinai Peninsula is the, what they call, solution for Gaza's Palestinians. And the piece claims that the Sinai Peninsula comprises one of the most, what it calls, suitable places on earth to provide the people of Gaza with hope and a peaceful future. When you read statements like the one you mentioned of Netanyahu or pieces like that, you've got to remind yourself that we're ultimately talking about what international human rights groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, what UN experts said on October the 13th. They've called this basically forced displacement a war crime, right? That's how it stands in international law.
That's exactly what it is. And that PC reference is one of many. And that, I think, goes to the heart of what I was saying before, that there has been, over the last decades, well before October 7, a radicalization within Israeli Jewish society. And I speak as someone Jewish myself, although not living in Israel, of course, I live outside. But it's something that really has struck me for a long time, that there are seemingly very few red lines amongst the global Jewish diaspora community. Of course, there are Jews who oppose what's happening, myself included. That goes without saying. But in terms of the mainstream Jewish diaspora organizations who are seeing what is being proposed in the US, in the UK, and elsewhere, they are not opposing it.
Right.
They're not saying this is outrageous, that you cannot remove people forcibly or so-called voluntarily from Gaza. It's an absolute red line that cannot be crossed.
That was investigative journalist and author Anthony Lowenstein speaking on Al Jazeera English.
Papa, I want to go home now. Papa, please take me home. Mama, please tell me I'm dreaming. And I'll wake up soon, and I won't be alone. Mama, it's dark here. Daddy, stop breathing.
That was Roger Waters, Under the Rubble. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Anne Garrison. The international rise of fascism is now manifest in the government of Javier Milei in Argentina. Milei campaigned to cut social services and shut down all union marches and strikes. He is a crony of Donald Trump and other right-wing demagogues around the world. Argentinian unions are threatening a general strike to bring him down. Puerto Rican labor researcher Ricardo Ortiz spoke with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer about this looming confrontation.
Javier Milei is quite a character. He has cloned dogs. He says he takes advice from his dogs. He seems to be pretty arrogant. He's never had a position. He's a professor. How did he end up as president of Argentina?
Well, it is a funny story, and it has some sides that people do not know. He was a professor of economics at a different Argentinian higher education institutes, but also he was a financial advisor to Corporación America, which is one of the largest conglomerates of communications and infrastructure in Argentina. Actually, the owner of Corporación America is Eduardo Urascain, which is the fifth most wealthy person in Argentina. So that's where he comes from. I mean, all this talk that he has attributed himself to be a guy that has no connections with the so-called political caste is a complete lie. Actually, during the presidential debate, his opponent, Sergio Massa, brought out a point that Milei got very nervous. He said, "Oh, remember, Javier, we used to be friends when you were working as an economist. You used to come to my office. What has happened?" And Javier Milei couldn't deny that fact. Also, Javier Milei spent a tenure working for Domingo Cavallo, which was the architect of privatization of the Argentinian economy during the tenure of Governor Carlos Menem, who did a lot of privatization and a big economic chaos in Argentina. That's where he comes from.
And the United States, of course, has a big role, has had a big role in Argentina. In 1976, they supported a military coup. Why did the United States do a military coup in Argentina? What was the result?
Well, they did perform a military coup due to the fact that the rule of the capitalist class, the Argentinian local bourgeoisie and the American influence was very questioned by youth movements, labor organizations. And actually, before the coup in 1976, there were already happening some worker strikes. The government had a crush insurgent youth military leftist movements, but the working class was rising in strikes. So in 76, they supported the coup against the government of Maria Perón, which was the second wife of General Perón.
And was the AFL-CIO involved in that coup?
Yes, they supported, and did not oppose. They knew, about it. And there are plenty of documentation of that. We can refer that to the National Archives, where there are documents not too long ago declassified showing the role of the United States and other institutions in the United States, such as the AFL-CIO.
And what happened after that coup? There were raids on plants, Ford plants, General Motors plants. Workers were kidnapped. A lot of workers lost their lives and their families were harmed. What was the result of that coup?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there were people that were tortured at Mercedes. There is a documentary on YouTube that talks about how people, workers were tortured in a Mercedes-Benz plants in Argentina, and in also in another factory plants owned by Ford and other multinational corporations. If the victims under the coup are estimated at 30,000 dead or missing, kidnapped by the junta. And these are numbers that the archives of the armed forces have shown. There were more. There were approximately 800 centers of torture. You can imagine the amount of people that went in through these centers. And people were, in the case of some nuns, they were launched into the sea by the Argentinian Navy airplanes.
One of the things that is important about Argentina is the mobilization of the poor people, Pollo Obrero, immigrants and others fighting for food. How have the working class organized and the oppressed organized in Argentina?
Well, I mean, in the words of the former Minister of Security, Patricia Bullrich, and the newspaper that is not, or a newspaper and conglomerate that are not certainly friends of the working class, La Nación, more than 10,000 pickets had this year that is exiting. I mean, it's a complete movement of organizations of the unemployed, of poor people. Also people that belong to certain oppressed identities. And also there is a current called Sindicalismo Combativo, Combative Trade Unionism, that gathers some caucuses within the unions and some unions, particularly SUPNA, which organizes in the multinational corporation Bridgestone. In the rail workers, there is a trade union leader that is very prominent, that is a socialist, Mr. Sombrero Campero. In other sectors, of this United Front, they have been participants and organizers of these rallies. In 2001, these piqueteros formed a national movement that occupied factories and were the ones that kicked out Mr. Rua out of the country. He had to be saved by helicopter.
Now, the rise of fascist movements, right-wing fascist movements, is growing. And in the United States, MSNBC, there's a section of the capitalist class that is talking about a fascist coming to power. If Trump comes back, he's going to implement fascist policies. Most of the left in the United States is not really united around any kind of united front. Why is this united front taking place in Argentina and not in the United States?
Well, in Argentina, first of all, this is a sector of the left, because it's not, let me clarify something. There are sectors of the left that they did support the Peronis, like the Argentinian Communist Party, like the Maoist Revolutionary Communist Party of Argentina. They did support the Peronist government.
On what basis did they support that government?
Well, because according to them, it was a democratic, anti-imperialist, nationalist government, you know, so it needed to be supported while the government was taking loans from the IMF, were repressing people in the streets. But I'm talking, this left that we're talking is an independent left, the Left United Front of Workers. It's an independent Marxist left that does not compromise with the government. And they came to do that because they realized, look, we have been fighting each other. Why don't we collaborate more with each other? You know, we are being killed. There are estimates that from 42 to 50% of the Argentinian people are poor. So, you know, we all are getting killed right here, are losing ground. So we should, you know, try to be more united and collaborate with our differences as much as we can. Well, I'm for certain convinced that it has a lot of success.
And the situation is explosive. It's growing. Opposition is growing in the working class. Are workers in Argentina prepared for the Milei government? And what will be the result if he is forced to leave by helicopter?
Well, I certainly know a couple of things. There is a lot of conscientiousness and a lot of anger. And even people that are like the union bureaucrats that were not ready to fight, they are now saying that they're going to oppose this.
He made fun of them, didn't he? Saying that they weren't really anything.
Yes. Actually, on Saturday, Milei and his security minister, she said that these people are inconformists. In the last years, they haven't done anything. But, you know, the majority of the people of the working class is not organized. Most people that work for on their own or work without being organized. So she made a challenge. She made fun of the unions. So now this is making people angry. Even the bureaucrats that have been, you know, more or less sleeping Cinderella now... they're saying that, they want to fight, that they're not going to allow this to happen. That is yet to be seen, you know, because one characteristic that the trade union bureaucracy has is that sometimes, commonly, they act like what one political philosophist said, like a middle caste. So to, you know, more or less mediate between the working class and the capitalists. But the anger that is being shown in the streets and people manifest this in interviews is too much. And I think that through this process, people will be awakening. And certainly the most leftist sector of the working class, which is a very educated and sophisticated working class, will start studying or realizing that we have to organize in different ways.
That was labor researcher Ricardo Ortiz speaking to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.